Do you have this thing that you do every morning?
Well, when I'm on the road, I do the same thing. When I'm speaking on the road, I do the same thing. I'll wake up, do some sort of exercise, even if it's just push-ups till exhaustion, sit-ups till I can't do anymore. Then I'll do a hot cold shower to wake up my body, and then I'll meditate for 20 minutes before I speak so that I've kind of like woken up the muscles, woken up my mind, I feel calm, grounded, and before I speak, you know, 30 or 45 minutes before I speak, then I'll make this coffee that has sort of like ghee and coconut oil and sort of a mixture of different things to really get me fired up.
Right. So how come you need to be fired up before you get on stage?
Well, I guess fired up is the wrong word. What I like to be is I like to be grounded. Mm. I like to be alert. And I like to be prepared. So the meditation actually helps me the most because it helps me become alert, but it also helps me prepare because when I meditate before I speak, I'll kind of distill a lot of the noise and separate like the things that are really important for me to hit, and I kind of zero in on those and also identify new things that I'm going to have to speak about that are pertinent to the audience that I'm speaking to. So it kind of is a time when I'm able to laser focus on the most important things that I'm going to be talking about. And that quiet is the only time I can kind of really hone in on that.
Mm. Do you get nervous?
Yeah.
Yeah?
For sure.
Well,
yeah.
What happens in your mind when you get nervous? What do you imagine? What are your fears?
I get nervous for specific speaking engagements, and it varies. Whether I get the most nervous when I know people in the audience, because if my friends are there,
right.
Because I get self conscious, and it's easier for me to speak in front of people that I don't know because I know I will probably never see them again, and so there's more pressure, and that's like I tend to worry about what other people think. In general, so that's sort of, I think, that plays into that. So I would rather speak in front of 20,000 people that I don't know versus 20 people that I do know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
For me, it's the opposite.
Really?
I love having friends in the audience because I can rest. I can just look at them when I need to feel loved or approved.
Yeah.
And I don't need to seek my approval from strangers. So sometimes when I'm really nervous, I bring friends and I tell them to sit scatter around in the room, so I can, you know, everywhere I look I can see a friendly face.
Yeah.
And I never sit behind this, like I never sit alone before going on stage. I always walk around in the audience and talk to people, because if I sit alone, I'm alone with my thoughts and my anxiety, and I worry a lot as well. So I learned that I'm not to be left alone before going on stage.
That's so funny, because I'm the exact opposite.
You need to be alone.
I need to be alone. I need some sort of quiet before, because it allows me to gather my thoughts and I start to run through some of the things, the most important pieces of the presentation. And a lot of times that's the very beginning. Because I know if I go out there and I really hit and nail the first couple minutes, then it's going to set me up for the rest.
Right.
Because I think the beginning and the end of a keynote or a presentation is the most important. And the beginning is the trickiest, because you're really trying to win the trust of the audience. And so those first couple sentences are always the most important. So I run through that. I think about those things that I've been meditating on beforehand too. And I just like to pace back and forth and kind of run through it in my head and then go out. But, you know, so a couple of times this year that I was really nervous. One was sort of the biggest speaking engagement in terms of numbers. It was maybe 20,000 people, but it was in Australia, and it was like, I get the most nervous when I know that it's not just a lot of people, but it means a lot. Like it's it's a moment in either my career or my, you know, a moment when if I really do really well, it's gonna have a large ripple effect in my life. And whether it's gonna like impact a lot of people or it's gonna impact me if I really show up in the best way possible. And so those are the times when I get, you know, really nervous, when I know that this is a moment where I can either make a right or a left. And if I make a right, it's going to change my life, you know, and make a left, it's like I'm going to lose that opportunity. So that's when I get nervous, when I know it's an opportunity where I can really make an impact and really like change the course of my trajectory.
And do you worry a lot, like in life in general?
Yeah. I'm a worrier for sure. I think that my metric for success is now, when I, you know, at 35, is sleeping through the night. You know, like if I sleep through the night and I don't wake up, I have nothing to worry about. For me, like that's where I want to be, because I overthink things. If I wake up in the middle of the night, I'll start to think about, you know, all these things that I have to do, or I'll think about things that, you know, are stressing me out. And when I sleep soundly throughout the night, then I know I have nothing to worry about. This is great. So, yeah. So I perpetually worry, and you know, my goal is to worry less. But you know, it's a double-edged sword, because the reason I think I'm in the position that I am and I'm doing what I'm doing is because I'm driven, and there's this fine balance between driving yourself forward and then driving yourself too much, where you're getting anxious, you're worrying, and it's becoming your Achilles heel. So, you know, it's gotten me to be able to speak to you, but it's also still something that I constantly struggle with.
So what made you nervous before this interview?
Before this interview, I didn't get too nervous because I knew that we were just gonna chat. But you know, I do worry a lot about things that I have to do every day, or things in my career, or you know, I mean, we have a wedding that we're planning, and I worry about that. You know, I just worry about things.
Mm. And do you picture, when you worry, do you picture things going wrong?
No, I just want to do everything really well, and so I think about all the things that I have to do in order to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly, you know, have this long list of things that I feel like I need to do. And then I continually, you know, think about, okay, oh, don't forget about this. We got to do this, and I got to prepare for this and that. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about.
Oh, that's where the list comes in.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I got it.
There you go.
That's a calming, comforting structure for.
Yeah. It helps me organize.
Yeah.
Like if you look at my phone, I have maybe like 15 or 20 different lists.
Yeah.
And it allows me to prioritize.
Mm.
Like I have my big ideas list of my big goals. Mm. I'll have my daily goals. You know, I'll have sort of like a whole slew of different categories of lists.
Well, it's a sense of order in a chaotic experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I do that as well. Some of my friends tease me for it, but I'm fine. I do lists for everything. Like I have a list on my phone, which is a list for dark days. Mm. So when I get really dark, like really sad or depressed, I have a checklist. So I go through my checklist, and every single time, it helps.
What are they?
Well, the first point or the first item in my checklist for dark days is call a friend. Mm-hmm. Let someone know you're sad, mm-hmm. because that's the toughest one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I tend to isolate, mm-hmm. and going to myself and not wanting to be a burden.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I do is I text like three of my closest friends. And I just text them like I'm having one of those days, and they know.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is I exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Like I run, or I do yoga, or I do like this really exhausting exercise. So my focus shifts from my head to my body.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a crying ritual.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
So I have a playlist for crying, and I have like this physical, almost like a physical meditation for crying, where I start out by tapping my chest and massaging my throat.
And that starts to trigger?
That releases the tears, yeah.
With the music?
With the music.
And how did you find those songs? Or is it just...
It's just songs that I know. I always cry when I hear those songs. They put me in a melancholy state. They're connected to situations and people that not necessarily makes me sad, but help me to connect. And when I'm in contact, when I'm connected, it doesn't matter if it's sadness or joy. I'm connected. Any emotion is welcome in that space. But the feeling I have some days when I say dark, I mean, it's like I need to be connected, but there's something, you know, preventing me from connecting.
You're disconnected.
I'm disconnected. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So it's sort of a cathartic way that you reconnect to your emotion.
Yeah.
That's cool. Another one that I like to, if I'm having a difficult day or a difficult time, is to help somebody else.
Yeah.
Because you take yourself out of your own head and you connect. It does two things. One, you can't think about how shitty you feel when you're thinking about someone else. So you physically cannot think about those two things at once. So you think about someone else versus yourself, and then you also build a connection with someone because you're doing something of service. And so that is, it's like Dale Carnegie talks about in his book, I think the title is Stop Worrying and Live Your Life or something like that. And his cure for, this was written 75 years ago, and his sort of prescription for depression is 14 days of service. Yeah. So help someone 14 days in a row.
Yeah.
And you'll feel better. And he says it works like 90% of the time
experience. For sure, it's an antidepressant. It's number 7 on the list, by the way.
Is it?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I started to do that when, I think it was maybe 5 years ago, I was sitting in a hotel lobby, you know, working as one does. And suddenly I was through my to-do list and I had 4 hours of nothing planned. So I went into Facebook and I just typed, is there anyone? No, I typed, what do you need help with today, buddy? So I just asked my Facebook friends if they needed any help. And people just started, you know, commenting, and they wanted help with, you know, I need to get a new apartment. I need help. Like, could you give feedback on my project? Could you connect me with this like profile or celebrity? And just, you know, lots of comments. And I tried to help as many people as I could, but I didn't. It was too fast, right? So people started to connect with each other and helping each other out.
Yep, that's cool.
So it was like after a few hours, it was like, you know, 500 or 600 comments. And then the day after, I did the same. And then people started to do that on their Facebook pages as well. They started to ask, what can I help you with today, buddy? And then a friend of mine, Dennis, started a Facebook group called What Can I Help You With Today, Buddy? So now it's, I think it's maybe 50,000 people helping each other every day.
Yeah.
So that was when I started to realize that there's something in the, of course, it wasn't like a brand new insight to me. I connected to that in other situations as well, but it was so clear that during those 4 hours, I felt so good. And the only thing I was doing was just, you know, like helping people in small ways and connecting people so they could help each other out.
Yeah, it doesn't take much to help someone sometimes.
No, and I also think the worrying, and I'm not talking like from your perspective, I can only talk for myself, but the worrying for me is when it's kind of a narcissistic, it's like, what about me situation? It's like a me voice. And I want to do good. I want to look good. I want to do this. And like the only thing that helps me to get another perspective is to think about the you perspective. How can I be of service? How can I help you? How can I support you? And that gets me out of my own head, but also out of my own focus. Like, it's not about me.
Yeah. Well, how can you feel depressed if you aren't focusing on you?
Yeah, and there's no I to be depressed, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, it like snaps you out of the inherent self-focus. You know, another thing, I have this like mental health toolkit that is, I always thought that it would be amazing if the government mandated this toolkit, kind of like they used to have the food pyramid where they'd tell you which, even though it's not really true, but, or it's not right, but the idea of like everyone should have a toolkit that they can reach into when they're feeling down, when they're feeling depressed, that they can try to help lift them out of those feelings, whether, and they're free, you know, they are accessible to everyone, because especially, you know, for me, when I got really depressed when I was in my first year of university, and it hit me out of nowhere. I mean, I was like, everything on paper was great. I was straight A student. I had a scholarship to university. I was on the national rugby team in Canada. I was, you know, had a ton of friends. It was great, but I put a lot of pressure on myself because I have this thing where I've, you know, always been really driven, as I was talking about, and I drove myself to just kind of exhaustion, and ultimately got depressed and dropped out of school. And, you know, I'd never experienced anything remotely close to this in my life. So all of a sudden I was back in my parents' house, unable to like really leave the house. I was totally immobilized. I was unable to make decisions. And I was like, fuck, what is going on? I couldn't, just everything I felt that I'd worked so hard for was suddenly just crumbling to the ground. And it was, I didn't know how dark and how deep that would go. And so I think for a lot of people, you know, there's some version of that that's very normal for people. When they hit, whether it's after high school, after college, or in their developmental years, where they hit some sort of crisis. And there's, if you don't know someone that's been through it, you feel like you're on your own, and you feel like you're fucked up.
Yeah.
And you're not. It's just sometimes part of growing up. And sometimes it is something that you may struggle with for the rest of your life, but there are a lot of other people that are also struggling with it, and they will, you know, and they're doing great things. And so just the one, knowing that you're not on your own in this struggle, there's a lot of other people that are going through something similar or worse, and they've gotten through it and you'll get through it too. Two, what can you do if you hit that low? When you hit that low, because everyone will go through some sort of mental health crisis in their life. That's just the data. Like, it's, by the way, most of these crises and suicides are from, you know, just life crises like bereavement or divorces, you know, things that happen in life. So this is something, this is part of the human condition. And so to be able to have a toolkit that, you know, okay, I'm going to go through it. When I go through it, I'm going to try these things and I'm going to talk about it. So it's like, as you said, like meditation, exercise, diet, gratitude, proper sleep, talking with a therapist or a coach or someone that you love about what, you know, you said, you really, what you're doing when you text your friends, you're reaching out. And that's what a lot of people don't do when they're in that time. And that is the most important, because when you don't reach out and you go inwards, you start to feel trapped because you don't know a way out. And when you feel trapped, you might do something that you regret. And so when you reach out to a loved one or a therapist or a coach or someone, that's an olive branch where you then have a lifeline. Yeah. And so when you text your friends and you say, hey, I'm having a good day, they probably text back, hey, you know what? I had a bad day last week. You're going to get through it. Or if you need anything, let me know. Or, you know, hey, let's go out. Let's go to the gym. Mm. And so,
and also next time when they feel bad, they reach out to you.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that is the often overlooked. It's you think that you're being a burden when you reach out to someone for help. What you're actually doing is you're opening the door for them to come back to you in their time of need, because they will. And so you're building this really important pathway of connection. And you're also, the whole thing, all this stuff is, it's the opposite of what is generally is considered the what happens, in the sense that when you reveal something or you're vulnerable, what you think is going to happen is that you're going to look weak. But what in reality happened is that people see that and then they actually look up to you because they're like, wow, you know what? You just went out and you just totally revealed something that was very vulnerable about yourself. And now I have this window into who you truly are. And I really have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah, but also when you're an influencer or you're a person with a big following or a profile or a celebrity, people look up to you and listen to you, you know, watch your videos. I mean, every famous person, every successful person I know has some kind of darkness, some kind of anxiety, but not all of them talk about it. So, I mean, I was talking to, was it yesterday? We talked to Tamer Katan, this really funny, warm guy in LA. He's a comedian and a podcaster. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I'm going to actually ask you the same question. I asked him, what don't you want people to know about you? So what are you hiding? And we did it during the Curious Game. I'm just like in a couple of moments going to let you in on that question as well. But he said, and it's in the video with Tamer, and he said, I don't want people to know that I'm actually a bad person or I actually feel like a bad person. And I think that's so common that we try to hide that part of us that we don't want people to see because that part feels ugly or worthless or bad. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things preventing us from being vulnerable, because I don't want people to see that I'm actually fucked up. Mm-hmm. And then you realize everyone's fucked up.
Totally, everybody is, yeah. And it's, I think, especially people that are, you know, have gained some sort of success. I you know how I was talking about at the beginning, like this worry is like my Achilles heel, but it's also the thing that's driven me to do what I've done, and sitting here with you is that's really why I'm here. I think that that's pretty consistent with a lot of people that are doing things at a high level. It's like you have this thing that is your gift, but it also is your curse in a sense, you know, and you hear this a lot. Like if you look at the end, like someone like brilliant, like Robin Williams, you know, yeah. He had this thing that plagued him, but it also was the reason and that he was who he was. And a lot of really artistic, creative geniuses, you know, happen to be bipolar. And, you know, there's, you can think about a lot of people that it's this fine line between genius and, sort of their crippling Achilles heel. And so that's, I believe, consistent in all humans. You know, it's just that we don't hear about it with everyday people because we don't talk to everybody and a lot of people don't open up about it. But like, if you really step back and look at what it means to be human is to struggle. You know, I think that's like what the Buddha says, is that that's what makes you human. And nobody is perfect. Nobody's got it figured out. All the people that you see that you think have it all together, they just don't, you know? And if they do, maybe they do one day, but the next day they don't.
Yeah.
And that up and down is just, you know, life. And I think that any time you hit those walls, you realize, okay, this sucks, but also what is the opportunity to learn about myself here, and how can I turn this struggle into a learning experience? It's not always easy to do, but like ultimately when you weather those storms, that's how you learn about yourself. It's like going through a hard workout. Like it sucks while you're doing it. Mm. But once you're through it, you're like, whoa, okay. They actually built something because I just went through the ringer. So yeah, it's like anytime I've opened up about my struggles, one, it's allowed other people to open up about theirs. So, you know, when you talk about the things that you've been through, you give other people permission to talk about theirs.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the way that we're going to sort of eliminate the stigma around mental health, is it's everyone's job to just talk about it. And you don't need to talk about it from a stage. You don't even need to talk about it to your friends, but to somebody that you either love or is a professional is I think important, you know, like to start that conversation in some way, shape or form, to someone that you trust or someone that is trained to, you know, help you work through it. Cause we, you know, that is then your grounds to start to grow. And then by doing that, the more people that talk about it, the more people will feel, okay, I'm not so fucked up. Like I guess I can talk about the thing that happened to me or the thing that I went through. It's like Chuck Palahniuk, yeah. You know, like, have you ever seen him speak?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I'm a big fan.
It's, yeah, I saw him speak. It was, I've never experienced anything like it. He's the author of Fight Club, and his one of the things that his purpose is to tell stories of people that are true stories, but are so unbelievable that a lot of times they've never, and so fucked up and so hard and so crushingly devastating that they've sometimes never told anyone in their life. But he tells them through, you know, this, through his books or through this live experience. And when I was there, there were people that were fainting.
Yeah. Was he reading the guts, guts story?
Yeah. That was one of them. Yep.
Because I think he has a body count of, I don't know how many hundred people who have fainted during his readings of Guts. Mm-hmm. And I actually I did this thing where I think it was first, it was published in Playboy. Mm-hmm. Like the first time it was published in Playboy. And I bought the magazine and then I copied the story. And then I just, you know, started to spread the story around in trains and in bus stops and in cafes in Sweden just to share it. It was like before social media.
Yeah.
But I just wanted people
reposting.
I wanted people to, yeah, I reposted it. Sorry, Chuck. I wanted people to read it because it was so, it's so physical. It's so,
oh my God,
gory. I love it.
It's so visceral. Yeah. One of the people that I was sitting next to got up and walked to leave. And like before he hit the door, he just fainted. Yeah. And so.
What's your favorite book with Chuck? Which one do you like?
The only one that I've read is Fight Club.
All right.
And a friend of mine invited me to this. I didn't actually even know much about him. This was back in 2000 and maybe 3 or 4. Maybe it was 2006 that I was invited to see him speak, and I didn't know anything about him. And you can imagine, like, walking into this auditorium sort of blind, and then I, you know, all of a sudden people are falling, you know, off their chairs and into the doors as they were trying to leave the room, and, you know, like gagging like they're going to throw up.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? I couldn't believe what was going on. And then, you know, by the end, you sort of understand, you're like, wow, okay, I get the purpose of this. Like at first I just thought it was a totally like fucked up, like, you know, show. But then, you know, you start to hear him speak once he finishes the stories and he's like, you know, I tell these stories so because the people that this happened to can't. And by me telling them, I lift that burden off of them. And it also allows and gives other people the permission to tell their stories because everyone has a story. And if you hear these, you think, wow, like my shit is not as bad as this. And then it's like the whole adage, like if everyone put their problems in the circle and you had the choice of like taking your problem back or choosing someone else's problem, you'd probably take your problem back. So
I love the part in Fight Club where the narrator is going to all these meetings. Mm-hmm. I've been doing the similar thing because I feel normal.
Yeah.
Like I'm not writing, because he's called a tourist. Mm-hmm. I think he's Mala Singer calls him a tourist, but it's not touristing. I think it's actually connecting. It's connecting and normalizing yourself and being around people who are willing to share their problems and their darkness. And, you know, if you go to NA or AA, it doesn't matter. You just sit in a circle. And I love sitting in circles and sharing with people.
Yeah.
And going like lap after lap after lap.
I know. It's fascinating. It's like one of my favorite things to do. Like I started this little men's group where guys share the best part of their week, the worst part of their week, and then the one thing that they're looking forward to. And it's just such a, it's such a fun, fascinating, meaningful thing to do. Like you actually, you can feel it in your chest that you're just connecting to people in a way that usually you just don't. Mm. You know, like you, once someone opens up and like creates that opening for everyone else to do the same, it changes the room, and then everybody just kind of shares, and you create a place where people feel safe to share, and usually you don't feel that safe.
Yeah, especially men, right?
Yeah.
And do you go to this men's group regularly?
Yeah, we just so my brother-in-law hosted a dinner for, and still does, and so, and then I started doing it as well.
Oh wow!
And so, but my dad did it and still does, and he has been doing it for 35, 40 years.
Really?
Yeah, and it's called. I just remember my dad would always go to men's group, and then he'd host the men's group at our house like every, you know, 6 weeks or something, or every two months. And it was like a group of, you know, maybe 6 to 10 of his friends. And someone would host it at their house every second week or something, and they would cook, and then everyone would sit in the living room and they'd talk, and then every, you know, couple months they'd all do a retreat. So I just remember him always, you know, hosting the men's group. And when they came, like we had to go upstairs and like, you know, hang out on our own because they needed their private space to talk. And then I thought, yeah, like I want to do something like that. It's just such a, and he still does it. And it's, as guys, we don't always have that forum to openly speak our minds.
That's beautiful. Imagine you're seeing your dad do that for 30 years. That gives you something. That like plants a seed of something in your mind as well. I think I started to explore men's group maybe I would say 7 years ago when my daughter was 3 years old, and I realized I don't have any of the tools I need to be a man. I don't have any tools I need to be a father, because my dad had, you know, he had his own problems, and he did his best, but I didn't have that many positive, you know, examples of being a mature man around me when I was growing up. So when I became a father, I realized that I'm still a boy. Mm-hmm. I'm a boy trying to raise a girl. That's impossible. And I talked to a lot of my friends, and a friend of mine, Henrik, he told me that there's this organization called the Mankind Project. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of him?
I think so.
It was a few friends. They came back from the Vietnam War, and they were just fed up with, you know, the part of men, you know, the part of masculinity, you know, creating violence and darkness and war. They called them the Shadow Warriors, and they wanted to help men to become more mature. And then they realized that there's no initiations in modern society. There's no initiations for boys to become men. Mm-hmm. And we need help to create that kind of initiation. So they created this retreat called the New Warrior Training. So helping shadow warriors become real, like warriors of love. And they do like this 3-day initiation. And then when you've done the initiation, you're supported and you're in a community of men, and you get support and a lot of, you know, tools and a toolkit to be able to start men's group and do the practice.
That's amazing.
There's a lot of those groups here in California as
well. Another good one is Everyman.
Never heard of it.
It's a men's group and sort of a retreat based around a lot of the same principles. And there are a lot more popping up, which is just fantastic. And it's, I think it's interesting that you're the catalyst for you going and searching out this men's group was when you became a dad.
Yeah.
And that was what my dad was also searching for, was like to connect with other men around being a father.
Yeah.
And also about to talk about relationships. You know, a safe place to talk about being a dad, struggles with raising kids, and also the ups and downs of a relationship. And he sent me a photo. It was funny. I posted it on my Instagram because I did my first men's group, and then I posted a photo of him at his last men's group,
oh, wow.
which is him and his buddies like out on a deck, you know, overlooking the ocean at one of their little retreats. It was like they just like rent a house and go for the weekend and cook and hang out and play music and drink wine and talk. And yeah, it's that's something that I think, you know, we all that need. That's why we like we look for meaningful relationships so that we can just be honest and talk about the things that are, you know, we're going through in our lives. And I think it's important that you create some sort of you know, accountability around that. Just create a system that you almost force yourself into sharing, clearing, you know, talking. That's why if you have a therapist, you go to them once every 2 weeks or something. That's why, you know, my dad at work, because they would every 2 weeks they do their men's group. Or, you know, that's why it's great when you, you know, have a friend that you have a, you know, your morning coffee or walk every week or every 2 weeks, or you do that with your partner. So you create the time that you prioritize just like you would anything else that's important.
So I don't want to forget the question, the question I asked Tamer as well. So I'm curious about what don't you want people to know about you? What do you want to hide?
Well, I've talked about two of them that I usually don't love talking about. One is the depression that I went through. And I guess it would be that I still go through, you know, I went through a bout of depression maybe 3 years ago, right? As I was building something with my friends, we started a production company and we'd gotten it to the point where finally we were getting investment and we were just about to kind of like take off, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I didn't love the work that I was doing. I wasn't being creative and I was just burnt out. And so I had to tell them, I said, guys, look, I can't, I'm not the guy to run this production company anymore. And I took a left turn and I didn't know what to do. And I accepted an invitation to speak because I'd done a TEDx talk years before. And that started this road into, well, unexpectedly into speaking.
Oh.
So, but you know, I think it's just the truth is this is something that I'll struggle with for the rest of my life. You know, I think it's just, and that's okay. You know, it's not ideal, but I am the type of person that will always need to pay close attention to how I'm doing. And I'll need to make sure that, you know, that I'm getting enough sleep and that I'm, you know, if I'm partying, that I don't do it for an extended period of time, that I'm balanced, that I'm not working myself too hard, that I'm, you know, being able to have things like hobbies and quality time with my fiance and, you know, these sort of things that keep me just healthy and understand what I need to be healthy.
Right.
And that's just taking time. You know, I think before when I was in college, like I didn't know what I needed. I didn't understand who I was. I didn't, you know, know what I needed to be healthy. And now I sort of have this toolkit of things that, okay, these are my levels that I need to keep to be healthy.
So with this perspective of you being vulnerable and us knowing about your worrying, I would love for you to tell us the story about how you started the bucket list.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have like an introduction of you as a like a human being before we get into the story that I imagine you've told so many times.
Yes, I love that. And the story starts in, well, really, I guess when I dropped out of school, you know, when I hit that first depression, everything was on paper fantastic, and I was blindsided. I was sort of knocked off my feet by these unexpected feelings and crippled by these, you know, these emotions, and I spent, you know, 3 to 4 months in my parents' house, unable to leave the house, and just couldn't go outside. And like, I was like, what the fuck is going on? I was so scared about how I didn't know where this was going and just felt like the only direction it could go is worse. You know, it could only go down. It could only get darker. And friends ended up coming to the house and kind of pulling me out of the house and, you know, convincing me to come work with them in a new town for the summer after I'd already dropped out of the semester of school. And as I kind of left my hometown, I was forced to do things on my own. Like, I didn't have a choice. Before, I was sort of, I couldn't decide whether I should go to school or not. I couldn't decide whether I should go to work or not. And ultimately, the indecision would be my decision, which was not doing anything. Where when I was in this new town, I had no choice. I had to get a job. I started to get some confidence, right? I started talking about what I was going through to my friends. Mm. I slowly started to kind of feel back to myself. And then I realized that I needed to talk with a therapist and understand why I was feeling this way. And, you know, and ultimately I found this new group of friends that were sort of inspiring. And there was this one kid that had started a clothing line in college, and I didn't know him too well, and he out of the blue, he started this clothing line, and I was so taken aback that he had just done this out of nowhere that I was like, man, how did you do that? Like, can I get involved? Is there any way that I could help you out? And he was like, yeah, sure. If you could get me some press, that'd be great. And he'd just taken out a loan and done this clothing line. And so I was able to get him in a blog that like got him some press. And I thought, wow, I can't believe I did that. You know, this is so cool. I got a hold of this guy that runs this big blog. And I just thought, man, if he did that, if he made this clothing line with no experience, like, I wonder what I could do. And I was like, I want to make a movie. And I had made this conscious decision to only surround myself with people that were going to inspire me, just like this kid that started the clothing line. And so I was like, who can I make a movie with? And I remember there was this kid that posted a video that he made on Facebook, and I knew him from the neighborhood, and his name was Johnny. And I called up Johnny out of the blue, and he knew my sister, but I didn't know him too well, but I sort of cold called him. I said, Johnny, you want to make a movie? And he said, yeah, sure. Like, I just was talking to my friend Dave about something similar to this. And I was like, I remember Dave because he went to my high school. And so we got Dave, Johnny, and Johnny's older brother, Duncan. And we started talking about making a movie. And this was kind of the inception of this idea, but we didn't know what the idea was. It was just like, we wanted to make something. We all had this, you know, we didn't know each other too well. We'd all been through shit, you know, recently, and we all had this desire to create something meaningful. And we thought a movie, a documentary, would be a really cool outlet. And so we started these conversations about what's the movie going to look like, kept hitting roadblocks, creative roadblocks. And then ultimately, Johnny and Dave went out to Montreal to go to school. And Johnny was at his freshman year at McGill, and his English teacher, you know, sitting in English class, and his English teacher assigned him a 150-year-old poem called The Buried Life. And so he reads the poem, and something in this old English poem strikes him, and he brings this poem back to us. He sends it to us. He says, guys, read this poem. And this poem was basically articulating the same feeling that we were feeling, which was like, we knew what we wanted to do, something meaningful. You know, we had all these things that we'd always wanted to do, but we just never done anything. And we'd never done any of them. And they felt buried. You know, they felt like there was these moments when we were inspired, and then they sort of get buried by work or by school. And so this was what was happening with this movie that we wanted to make. We'd get inspired by an idea, but the day-to-day had, you know, we wouldn't do it, you know? And then we'd get another idea, and then, but we had this burning desire to do something. And so we thought, man, this guy 150 years ago is feeling the same way we felt then, but it was, you know, almost like, you know, halfway around the world, a century later, we're like, well, I guess we're not the first people to feel like this. Why don't we take this name, The Buried Life? And we weren't sure what the film was going to be about, but we knew that it was going to be, the essence is going to be about this idea of being buried. And so we thought, okay, how do we unbury our dreams? And we decided to ask this question, what do you want to do before you die? Because the thought of death was the one thing that kind of put things in perspective for us. And so we asked ourselves this question, and that's where the bucket list started to form, because when we asked what do you want to do before you die to ourselves, there was this long list of things that we wanted to do. And so we wrote this list, and when we wrote it, we pretended that we could do anything and that, you know, we had all the money in the world. And we thought, okay, let's go after this list for, we'll go on the road and we'll try and cross off as many things as we can. And every time we cross something off, we'll help a stranger we meet to cross something off their bucket list. So we'll ask ourselves the question, what do you want to do before you die? But we'll also ask strangers. And so that was the mission. And this was in 2006. And this was going to be a 2-week road trip. And we bored an RV. We got a camera on eBay. We threw parties to fundraise. We did whatever we could so we could just hit the road for 2 weeks before we went back to school. And so the mission was to do that, cross things off, help other people, and we hit the road. And the surprising thing that happened is that as we left, people started to hear about it. And we started getting these emails and people said, hey, I saw your list online. Number 9, ride a bull. I can help you get on a bull. Or I saw you want to make a toast to a stranger's wedding? My best friend's getting married. I'm the best man. I can get you in. And this just inpouring of offers. It's like when you posted on Facebook, you know, people started to help each other. Mm. And so this is what was happening. And we're like, oh my God, we didn't think anyone would care about our list. Like we thought we would just ask other people. We'd make the documentary about helping other people. We'd do our list on the side because it'd be fun. But we didn't think that people actually care. But what happened was people started to get inspired to think about their dreams just by us going after our dreams. And so this idea of the ripple effect started to sort of like bubble up. In hindsight, you know, as I look back, that's something that we definitely didn't realize starting, was that like when you do what you love, you inspire other people to do what they love. So it's not selfish, it's actually service, because you're giving other people permission to do that thing that they want to do. And then, you know, simultaneously as people would send in offers to help us with our list, they would send in their dreams asking for help with their list. And so we were getting all these dreams sent to us. You know, can you help me do this? Can you help me do that? And so this 2-week road trip, we came back, we had crossed off these list items that we never thought we could. We had helped people that we never thought we could help.
Could you tell us about the girl who hadn't visited her mom's grave?
Yeah. So we were in Memphis, and usually what we do is we just ask people that we encounter on the street, what do you want to do before you die? And it's kind of a weird thing to say to someone, a stranger. And usually it takes a bit of warming up before they actually open up. But when we asked this particular girl, she said, I want to find my mom's grave. And we said, could you explain? And she said, well, we were in New Orleans for Katrina, and my mom, they evacuated, and my mom got on a bus to go to Denver, and she died, and they buried her somewhere, and I don't know where, and I've never seen her grave. And and so we were able to track down where her mom was buried, and Johnny and Dave, two of the other guys in the group, flew with her and ended up being in Denver. And in this sort of, it was a massive graveyard, and they ended up finding her mom's grave and sort of sat with her as she kind of collapsed by it and started to cry. And, you know, finally got the bit of closure from that. But, you know, the experiences that we've had when we've sort of been able to step into someone else's life in a moment that means so much to them, and doing that one thing that they've always wanted to do, you know, talk about meaningful connections. I mean, that's like, it just immediately you share this thing that bonds you for a long time, but also the feeling of Yeah, it's just being able to help facilitate that in a small way ends up being almost more gratifying than those big items on the list that, that we've crossed off on our own. So it was a very unexpected road that we went down. You know, this was like supposed to be just a 2-week road trip. And all of a sudden, you know, 13, 14 years later, still continuing to do it in a way that's evolved, but now it's sort of become this almost way of life, you know, a philosophy almost. And we stumbled into this framework that actually really works and makes sense when it comes to this human condition that we have of feeling buried, right? Like this isn't, there's not, it's not coincidence that this poet, Matthew Arnold, in 1852 wrote this poem of feeling buried. This happens to everybody. This is part of the human experience, is that we don't do our personal goals as human beings. We typically push them because we feel like we'll do them later, and we push them till tomorrow or next week or next year, until 76% of people realize that they're out of time. They don't have time to do the things that they want to do because they're dying, right? So there's this really mind-blowing study out of Cornell that by a psychologist named Tom Gilovich, who found that most people get to the end of their life, they don't regret the things they did, they regret the things that they didn't do. And so 76% of people on their deathbed that he talked to, their single biggest regret in their entire life is not living my ideal self. So it's living the life that someone else wanted for them, not the life that they wanted, which is heartbreaking. Mm. You know, you're talking about over 3/4 of the population laying on their deathbed, looking back on their life and thinking, fuck, I blew it. I lived for someone else, or I pushed my own goals to the point where now I don't have any time to do them. And so the idea of writing down your goals, the idea of sharing them, which were two things that we just did because for us it was the only thing that made sense to remind us that they were there, ultimately starts to build accountability, and it starts to allow other people to help you. So when you write down your goals, you make them real. When you share them, you give other people the chance to help you. When you dream big and you go after things that are, you know, you feel may be impossible, just by you taking the first step towards them, you have a leg up on 99% of the other people because they never take that first step. And so we just found that these dreams that we put on the list that we thought were impossible, that we wrote kind almost as a joke. It was like, what is the most impossible thing we can ever think of? Play basketball with President Obama at the White House. Do an interview with Oprah. Have a beer with Prince Harry. Make our own TV show. Write a number one New York Times bestseller. Like, they all happened over time. And so we kind of got to this point where we're like, holy crap, I guess you can do anything. And so it changed the way that I fundamentally operate, you know, it like actually changed my DNA, where it got to the point where it's not, can I do this? It's, do I want to do this? Mm. Because I know that I can do it, because I have the ability to do anything, just like you have the ability to do anything and everyone has the ability to do anything. It's, do I want it enough to put in the work that I know is going to be needed to accomplish that thing?
Is there a cost to that?
Yeah.
As well? I mean, the ability and the opportunity to do anything, I mean, for a person that worries a lot.
Yeah. No, there is a cost. And that's why you have to be okay with the what you're going to have to give up to make that happen. So you really have to be wanting it for the right reasons. Yeah. You know, and there are things that we did that now I wouldn't do them again, you know, but at that time in my life, that's what I wanted to do. And like, that's why oh, like streak a field and try and get away,
yeah,
or survive on a deserted island, or, you know, like ask out Megan Fox on the red carpet, or just like, you know, things that we, you crash the Playboy Mansion, like bizarre things that we'd at the time, you know, we really wanted to do. And, yeah, and but that's okay. Like, I think your list is a reflection of who you are. So it's important to revisit your list every X months. So every quarter, every year, you know, I have this thing where my fiance and I, we do our resolutions at the end of the year. And so we have our list of goals that are, you know, our shared goals, then there are my goals, then there are her goals. And we have this one document that is sort of throughout the years, you can see 2017, 2018, and you kind of each year get to see what you've been able to accomplish. You carry things over to the next year. And so it's a fluid reflection of who you are. But it really is just, you know, if you break down what a bucket list is, or any type of list. I think bucket list is a tricky term for it because it's sort of cliche, and, you know, it's, but if you strip away the name and you just look at what is this thing, it's just a list of the most important things to you in your life.
Yeah.
That's it. The things that you believe will bring you the most happiness, the most joy, the most fulfillment. Now, the list itself is just a device so you don't forget about those things.
Right.
Because if you don't have something to remind yourself, they get buried. That's been happening for hundreds of years. That's just what happens. So, you know, you need some sort of reminder. And maybe it's not a list. Maybe it's something, maybe it's a reminder in your phone. Maybe it's something on your calendar. Maybe it's a meetup with your friends. Maybe right. It's a
prayer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Find that thing that reminds you of those things that are important to you, and take the time to think about what those are, right? Like, find quiet to reflect and put in the time it takes to identify those things. Now you've done that. That's the hard work. Now just how do you keep those top of mind?
Right.
And so that's the trick. And the list, you know, we went after huge, audacious, crazy goals because that was kind of what we wanted to do. It was our job. Yeah. And, but just because they, if you have a goal that's doesn't feel like it's a huge, audacious moonshot, it is just as important as those big goals, right? So like, the equalizer is that it's important to you. That's what's important.
Mm.
So if you have a big crazy goal, it's important to you, boom, go after it. If it's something like call my mom once a week to tell her that I love her, or spend more time with my family, or take quiet time for myself once a day. I mean, it's different for everybody, but I think that the unifying message is like, take the time to think about it, write it down or put it somewhere where you're going to be reminded of it, and then create a system so that you revisit that and you keep it top of mind, because that awareness, you know, most people don't have it, and they end up with that regret.
So what items are left on the list and how many?
Now we have 9 left on the original 100.
On the original one, yeah.
And then, you know, I've a lot of other lists, and the list has changed over time. But, you know, if we just think about that original 100, which is sort of like this almost the ceremonial list, there are 9. And the list items that we're working on is to finish the movie, right? Number 93 is make a movie. And so that's why we started Buried Life, and we haven't finished it yet. And
the movie is the documentary.
Yeah,
right?
The documentary. Yeah,
yeah.
And the last item on the list is go to space, and so that's what we'd like to finish the film with, is some sort of go to space, and so that's, I guess, been the holdup.
And what does count as space? I mean, we were already in space.
Yeah, no, I know, it's true. It's got to be in our minds something significant. You know, we want to be able to see the curvature of the Earth. We sent our book to space.
What do you mean curvature?
Well,
the Earth is flat.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. I guess we want to see the corner.
The corner, yeah.
Yeah. We actually sent our book to space. We made this promise that if we got if our book hit number one New York Times, we'd send it to space. And we didn't think that we would hit number one, and then we did. And we thought, oh, crap, we got to figure out a way to send our book to space. And so two of the guys' old neighbor is a retired aeronautical engineer. And so we built this totally outrageous contraption with a weather balloon and this box with a GPS and a GoPro, and we attached the book to it, and we sent the book up in the weather balloon with a parachute. So the balloon went up, and weather balloons, they expand, and then once they get to a certain altitude, they pop. Yeah. And so the idea was like, okay, it's going to go, it's going to pop, parachute's going to deploy, and then we're going to have this GoPro capturing the ride, and we'll be able to take a screenshot of that. And then the GPS will track it as it falls, and then we'll be able to find it in the desert. So we go out to the desert, we like send up this weather balloon, and it goes up, and then we start tracking it as it comes down, and then we lose track of it like as it's 300 feet above the earth, and we're scanning, we're walking in the desert, holding a GPS, but we can't, it's not working, and we don't find it. And then 3 days later, the GPS pops back on, and then we find it, and this GoPro is still intact.
Really?
And we have this, if you Google the Buried Life space book, you'll see the photo of this book, and you can see the flat earth behind it.
So 9 items left, and what's the plan when you guys are done?
I mean, I guess we die. I don't know. I think that we all, I've been doing a lot of speaking, and I've really enjoyed that. And so my goal is to continue to spread this idea and give people permission to do those things that are important to them, and give them hopefully like some boosts to do the things that they really want.
So do people contact you or come to you with their bucket lists or the need to create one?
Yeah. But the cool thing now is that, like you found when you post on Facebook, friends would help other people.
Yeah.
So I'll have people that will see me speak or something, and they'll write down their list, and then I'll see them 8 months later, and they'll come and they'll show me the photo of like, they just reconnected with their biological father. So I had this one guy, he showed me his list, and it's the number one thing was reconnect with his biological father. And he sent me a photo like 5-6 months later. He tracked him down, and he had met a bunch of 7 new siblings. And this is a man in his early 50s. And so to see people not just like kind of get inspired, but also follow through and do those things that they've been thinking about for years or decades. That's the goal. Like another woman, she was a mother of 4 or 5, and her list was she wanted to learn how to swim. And she was just like, I've never known how to swim. I've always been self-conscious about it. And she sent me an email. She said, hey, I just learned to swim, but the coolest thing about it was not just learning how to swim. It was the way that it changed the way my kids looked at me. And they saw their mom conquer something that they knew she was so afraid of. And that was the most meaningful thing. So, you never know what can happen when you actually take that step to accomplish your goal. Because I feel like there is this ripple effect that happens. You do affect more people than you really know. And so when you do those things, you're affecting the people around you, and that ripple goes far beyond. So I think that idea of a ripple effect, if you think about, so there's been people that have been inspired by Buried Life to go after their goals. And a lot of times people have done things that have just been unbelievable. Like Yes Theory, a group of guys that have created, you know, one of the most amazing YouTube channels on YouTube, making inspiring content, inspiring millions of subscribers. You know, Buried Life was a big inspiration for them, and there's a lot of different people out there that are doing much greater things that have inspired many people. And you think about the people that they've inspired, what are they doing in this sort of like exponential impact? But you draw that back, it doesn't come back to us. Who it comes back to is this kid that started the clothing line that inspired myself and even the other guys to begin Buried Life. Now, this clothing line, you know, back in 2006, it wasn't successful. It doesn't exist anymore. But just his act of doing that thing that he'd always wanted to do changed history, you know? And that's proof that one person can make an incredible impact. And that's the power of the ripple effect.
So where's this guy right now?
Right now he's in New York and he's an artist. Yeah, he's a painter. He painted that right there.
Oh, wow. So you guys are still in contact?
Mm-hmm.
You're still friends. That's nice.
Yeah.
That's amazing that and the clothing line is...
Yeah, the clothing line, it just didn't work out. Or like, you know, it was just kind of, he did it for a couple of years. He didn't continue. And, you know, some people might say, oh, that's a failure. And then right. You look at the other side, you're like, the impact that's had, you know, it's crazy.
What I'm thinking about right now is that, so when I hear your story, I'm reminded that 11 years ago, I did something similar, but in a much, much smaller scale. So I was doing some work in Swedish public radio and I was doing some music and you know, a lot of work in Swedish media. And I got sick of, I got sick of, you know, the whole, you know, reporting on what other people did. Mm-hmm. You know, I was tired of, you know, not creating anything myself, just being like a film critic, a movie critic and talking about what other people were doing, reporting and doing interviews, but not actually doing something myself. So I quit my job and I started a blog called 365 Things You Can Do. So I did one new thing every day for a year. Mm-hmm. And this was 2009. And the blog had a great following in Sweden. And we did like a bunch of stupid stuff, me and my friends. We just gathered like 200 people who wrestled in a square. We did like a flash mob way back when flash mobs weren't even a thing.
Yeah,
and we created like these pieces of street art, and I went parachuting. I stalked a guy for 4 hours. You know, a bunch of still silly weird stuff. I ate cat food.
It's delicious.
It's not delicious. It's really, really not. but I tried it and I did that for a year and I wrote a book and I did a lot of, you know, motivational talks in Sweden. And I did that for I could ride that wave for 10 years almost. Mm-hmm. But now I'm like, I need to do that again. I need to revisit, not that list, but I need to revisit my own curiosity. And I'm doing it in some way with the podcasts, but I'm getting ready to do another list, I think.
Yeah, it's a great, I think that it's really important that we are open to the idea that it's not just okay, but it's healthy to recycle our careers in some way, shape, or form. And by career, I mean like anything that is either, it could be your job, but it could also be your creative expression or hobby or something like this. So this idea that we're evolving as human beings, and so the things that we're doing should reflect that. So for me, you know, I came to this point when I told you about the production company, I just got to the point where I was like, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. And I felt really conflicted about leaving because I was like, I put in 3 years, I've worked my ass off. We finally got it to a place where it's working. And now like, I'm going to have to start from square one and do something else. What am I going to do? I've, you know, is this a stupid idea? And then I talked with my uncle, and my uncle was like, yeah, you know what? This is called recycling your career. And you're not starting from the bottom. You're taking everything that you've learned and you're pivoting, right? And when I saw it like that, I thought, yeah, I guess you're right. I'm just going to pivot, and I'm just going to follow my curiosity and, you know, whatever, and see sort of what happens. And that's when I started speaking, and that changed this chapter of my life. And I think that right now I'm in that same sort of position where it's like, now I want to write another book, or, you know, I want to do a show or a podcast and start to move in another direction. And I think that a lot of times we feel like that's not a good idea, and that's not the right idea, because we've been going in one direction, we've been building, and that's the lane that we should stay in, because we've built, you know, we've put so much time and energy into this one thing, and we're climbing the ladder, we're moving towards the thing that we, the ultimate goal. And to deviate from that is not a smart idea. But if you, all the people that I look up to are doing so many different things, and their career has evolved. And you know, at one point they were in movies, and then they went into music, or then they went into this. And I think that when you really allow yourself the freedom to follow your heart and to follow that curiosity, then you start to find that you're going to move around, and you're going to continue to kind of cross those borders, and that's okay.
Maybe also next to your bucket list, mm-hmm. you should have a fuck it list.
Yeah, I
know. Right. So you can some items you don't like, the production company, you could put that on your fuck it list. Yeah. I don't want to do this, yes. And it's okay.
Yeah, right? Totally. Yeah, there's a guy that did a TED talk on a fuck it list.
Really? So,
yeah. He's from Vancouver, actually.
Oh wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I met him. Yeah, he's a cool guy. But yeah, I think that like knowing the things that you don't want to do is almost more important than knowing the things that you want to do, which is why it's good to do things and then stop doing them, because then now you know, okay, that's not something that I want to do. And like, especially when you're in college and you're trying to figure out what your major is and what you're going to do with your life and your career, how are you supposed to know? You can't. So like, it's okay if you change your mind. It's okay if you come out of college, try something for a couple of years, you realize that being a doctor is not what you thought it was going to be. Okay. That's okay. Stop, pivot, recycle, and move on to something else.
That might be like a moment when you get out of college, or when you move out of your parents' house. I think that's a good time to create like the list, mm-hmm. like the first version of the list. Where I'm at in my life, I just like a year ago, my fiance left. And I'm moving to a new city. So that's also like a new chapter mm-hmm. of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talked about life crisis before. Mm-hmm. I think there's an opportunity there to recreate yourself. Maybe mm-hmm. that's the good point to get a new list.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, I read something about like, you know, this, when you are at your lowest, it's almost, it is an opportunity to try something new, because you almost don't have anything to lose. You sort of like, okay, here I am. What's something, how can I recreate myself in this moment of darkness and try something new and see if I can, you know, forge down a new path.
And when you guys ask people, what do you want to do before you die? What was like the most common answer? What kind of answers popped up?
We got a lot of travel. I think travel is probably the number one sort of the bucket that most people gravitate towards, like, or some sort of adventure list items. But travel is a big one. But I think that as important, you know, the whole adventure list items, like, you know, a lot of people will say skydive, or a lot of people will, you know, do things that are sort of exciting. I think that's where we gravitate towards when we think about a list. But it's important to there are 12 or so categories of life to think about when you're writing your list. So there is adventure, but there's also spiritual, there's also material, there's also professional, there's emotional. There's all these different categories of life that you want to consider when you're writing your list. And so I believe that your list should be sort of a very well-rounded reflection of your wants, needs, and desires. And so if your knee-jerk is to go to adventure list items, push yourself into other aspects of your life and see, you know, professionally, what do you want to do? Material's okay. You know, you really want a beautiful watch? Great. Put it down on the list, you know? Emotional, like what are you afraid of? What are things you want to overcome? What's holding you back? What are your limiting beliefs? And so I think that that's sort of, I'd love to like sort of change the definition of what you think a bucket list is.
Have you like ever written a guide to create your bucket list? Is there like a Ben Nemtson guide to create your own bucket list out there?
There's nothing on paper, but I do that a lot in workshops and that type of thing. And it's like sort of walking people through the process of
thinking about it. If we wanted to like help or inspire the people listening right now, could we do like a 5-step guide or like something, you know, easy, shareable to share?
Yeah. Yeah. So the first step is you want to get a journal or a notepad, something that you're going to keep, something that you actually treasure in some way, shape, or form. So it can be a piece of paper, but it's better if it's in a journal because then you can revisit it over time and you can continue to write your list in that one journal. So grab a journal. Step two is to take, you know, at least 30 or 45 minutes, you know, by yourself, quiet time to start to write your list. Stream of consciousness, anything that comes to mind, what have you ever wanted to do? And pretend that you have $10 million in your bank and pretend that you can do anything. And think about these 12 categories of life. And if, you know, you can Google, there's a book called The Dream Manager by Matthew Kelly. And he talks about these 12 categories of life that I just mentioned. So you can sort of reference that. And make sure that you hit list items in all those buckets. And then you want to share your list. Again, I keep coming back to that Facebook post. I think that was really cool because what happened was when people shared, they then opened themselves up to other people helping them. And most people don't do that because of fear, right? Because of the fear of what other people think or the fear of failure. So fear stops us. But once you get over that fear, you realize that if you don't share your list, no one can help you. So look at your list and see, let's say your list item is to write a book, but you have no idea where to start. Think about people that might know an author and reach out to them. Hey, do you know an author? Or I know that your uncle wrote a book, or I know that you wrote a book. Is there any way I could jump on the phone for 15 minutes to pick your brain? I'm just trying to get started here, and I'd love to learn how to make a book proposal. You know, just like you can send out your, you can kind of post it wide and ask for help, or you can be strategic about it and try and actually like be intentional about your sharing. And then you want to just continue to be persistent in your pursuit of this thing. Because most people, they just give up, right? Like it's not easy. You have to continue to work your ass off to get it done. And then along the way, you want to help other people. Because when people see you helping others, they want to help you. And, you know, it's this ecosystem that you want to create of like doing things for yourself and helping other people. So to recap, you know, find a journal. Take time to write your list. Think about the 12 categories of life. Share that list and be persistent and give back.
Perfect. I'm going to do that. I'm going to write my bucket list for this year. I'm going to do 12 items, like one item in every category.
But, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so from a year... In a year from now,
yeah.
I'm going to show you the list.
Good. Thank you. I love that. And I would actually encourage everyone that's listening to, once they write their list, take a photo of it and share it with both of us.
Yeah.
Tag me on either Instagram or Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Ben Nempton. And then, you know, we can be everyone's accountability buddy, because you're 77% more likely to achieve your goal.
For sure.
If you have someone checking in with you down the line. So that's why, you know, as you write your list, if there's a friend that you want to accomplish a goal with, that's even better, because then you're keeping each other accountable. So if you can create accountability, you know, you create accountability by writing down your goals. You create accountability by sharing your goals, because then you feel accountable to the people you shared. You feel accountable if you have someone that checks in on you. That's why it's, when you have a boss, it works, because they're keeping you accountable. Because if you don't, you know, there's consequences. You're going to get fired, and they're the ones that are monitoring you. So that's why you do it. So you need those same mechanisms around your personal goals, or you're going to say, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it next week. I'll do it next year. So all these things are designed to create accountability, and they're also designed to create inspiration through action. So a lot of times we think, okay, I have this big goal, write a book. I don't even know where to start. Well, just by starting writing that first page, just by starting to reach out to someone asking for help, those small steps, they start to build inspiration, right? It's like if you're waiting to feel inspired to pick up the guitar and play, you don't pick it up. But when you just like sit down and you just start, you start to be like, oh, you start to feel inspired. You know, you're like, oh yeah, I'm actually feel like I'm doing something. And then you kind of that, it's like pushing a little snowball over the hill. It starts to grow as it goes. So you want to build that momentum. And that's why these little small steps of action are super important. They may seem trivial, like, oh, okay, what is it going to do? I'm writing down my goals, whatever. Well, you're making it real. You're creating a reminder. Now it exists. It's not a thought. That's a bit of accountability. Sharing my goals, or what is it going to do? And am I just going to throw it out in the ether? No, because like when you post your goals on social media, you then think, damn, everyone knows I have these goals. I better start doing them. Mm. When you share your goals with a friend, they know.
So talking about asking for help, is there any one of the nine items left on your list that I can help with, or the people listening?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, we're actively trying to figure out space. So like if there's any connection, or, you know, we're sort of following all leads and talking with NASA, or, you know, and SpaceX and Blue Origin, all the major commercial spaceflight companies, and even other private ones, like, you know, overseas, that we're just exploring it. So that is the only way that is going to happen, is through the collective effort of the community. And just, you know, I feel like it's going to happen in a way that's unexpected. And we want it to happen in a way that's kind of hasn't been done before. So, and we're sort of working with the Yes Theory guys too on that, to create something that like would be really memorable. So the goal is with that, is that will sort of be the big ripple that will, you know, hopefully inspire many more people. And ultimately that's the theme of the documentary as well. And so, yeah. So, and I think that if you could, you know, I just think that if people write their list and start going after it, like that for me is all I could really ask for. Cause I think that that has exponential impact. It's more of an impact than I'm going to have.
Yeah, I'm really inspired by our conversation, not only about the fact that I'm actually going to write my bucket list, but also with a sense of vulnerability and humility we started out with in the beginning, and also have like a fuck it list next to it.
Yeah,
so I could just move some of the items that I don't like. Because I'm actually going to write that list. I've been waiting to do that for a long time, and I'm really glad I got the opportunity to talk to you and get inspired to actually do that for the first time in a while. And there's a couple of really meaningful and emotional items on the list. It's a couple of adventures, but I feel a bit scared about the emotional ones.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah,
I think that it's amazing that you've shared that because you know that that is going to be a real driver in you actually accomplishing them. Because
now I have to do it.
You have to do it.
Really?
Yeah.
it's like there's a part of me that hates another part of me right now. Like if the anxious, worrying part of me had a voice right now, it would be like, what the fuck, man? Not again.
Yeah, I know. And that's when you know, like, that voice is like, whenever I hear that voice, it's half of me is like, that's, now I know I have to do it. It's like that voice that's like, don't do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I usually imagine like myself being like a car, and there's a driver, and there's another guy sitting in the passenger seat. Mm-hmm. So the driver is, you know, he's crazy. He's like, I want to jump with the car. I want to fly with the car. I want to do this. I want to do this. And the guy in the passenger seat is just shaking his head, going, I hate you so much right now. I hate you. I just want to sit here drinking my coffee and be left alone. And you're a crazy ass driver.
Yeah. Take me home.
Take me home. Yeah. Pull over. Yeah. So for the people listening right now, I mean, you have a huge following. People can easily Google you, but just to be safe, how can our listeners get a hold of you and follow you?
I think Instagram is probably one of the best ways, because I'm pretty active on, I'm most active on Instagram, but also when it comes to direct messaging, like I try and be pretty active with my messages. And so that would probably be the best. Twitter is also a good one. And yeah, I would love to see your list. So if you feel like, you know, sharing a photo, whether it's like tagging me in it on your story or in your feed, then I'll try and repost it and get more people to, you know, the more people that get eyes on it, then the higher chances that you're going to do it. So, or you can always find me on my website, which is my name, bennempton.com, and there's a place that you can email me to if you want to email me. So
thank you so much for inviting us to your beautiful home, Ben. And I hope we'll keep in touch, and I see you in 1 year.
Yes.
I promise you, I've been doing my homework.
I can't wait, dude. I can't wait to see what you've done.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.